Okay, I very much enjoyed the OA meeting. I want to thank the people for organizing that. It's so nice to have sharing, and I know how hard it is. Well, no, I know how hard it would be for me to listen to me. I know, you know, and just to listen without really participating is not easy, and it's a lot easier to talk than to listen. I found that out. So I really appreciate it. I have so much information to give you that it makes it difficult. Is this on, by the way, Nina? This is on? Okay. So much information that I've been given that I want to give to you that I... anyway, it'd be nice to share more. I've been asked a lot of questions, and I'm saving a lot of them up for different points when I discuss certain steps. I was asked one that leads me to believe that I may have given you the wrong impression. I talked yesterday about the two publications, Fourth Step Inventory Guide and the OA Workbook, and I said they did not represent the group conscience of OA. They don't. They were not approved by the World Service Business Conference, but they were approved by the Board of Trustees of the Overeaters Anonymous, and the Board of Trustees has the right to publish certain documents. So it is OA. It's not only approved literature in the sense of it doesn't represent the group conscience as to how to work the fourth step or how to work the steps, but it is put together by the Board of Trustees, so it's approved literature in that respect. It also represents what has been done with those is to create questions out of the OA 12 and 12. That's all it is. So I just wanted to make sure of that. Secondly, I understand we have a completely new newcomer here, and I'm not going to point any names because I would be shy. I would be shy if I were that person, but who just came right now. So I just want to introduce myself. I'm Laurie. I'm a compulsive overeater, and to welcome the newcomer. I've already been speaking quite a bit about the problem, and I'll just summarize the problem and then talk more about what the solution is. But I will say that I just to qualify slightly, I have been free from the bondage of food for over 20 years. I have not wanted to eat the foods that used to beckon to me. That is a miracle for me. I can have foods around me and not want them, and that is a miracle. And if that's a miracle for anyone in this room, then they know what I'm talking about. The problem, as we discussed earlier today, was that we can't stop once we started, and we can't stop from starting. So we are in a vicious circle that we either haven't started yet, and we're hanging on, and then we give up and we start again. And then once we start again, we can't stop until a certain point. Maybe we go on a diet or something, then we stop, and then we're fine, and we lose some weight, and then our mind tells us that we can start again. And we just go through that cycle over and over again. With many of us, certainly with me, it was a progressive cycle. It just got worse and worse. Every time I lost the weight, I gained it back, and it got worse and worse and worse. I was a three-time lifetime member of a popular weight loss program, and every time I reached my goal weight, I gained it back. I gained the weight back and worse. And so it became harder and harder for me to lose the weight. I believe, and I really do believe, they talk about this being a progressive illness. I believe that if I went back to eating after 20 years, I believe, as they say, that my body is doing push-ups outside this room, and it's waiting for me to get out. And once it gets out, and if I ever ate the foods that my killer foods, my binge foods, I believe I would be in a terrible shape. I heard someone say once, I know I have a relapse within me, but I'm not sure I have another recovery. And I think that may be a little dramatic. I certainly like to live that way. Well, if the problem is that I'm doomed on my own, how do I get any hope that there is a solution? I get the hope by coming to these rooms, and I got the hope by coming to these rooms and finding people who had what I wanted, in whom there was a miracle. They knew what they were talking about. I knew that they had suffered the way I had suffered, or they had the same problems that I had. And I knew that they didn't have that anymore. And once I knew that, I wanted their solution. And what they told me was very simple. We found a spiritual solution. we found a way by which we had conscious contact with a God, a higher power of our understanding. Well, I had problems with that. I wanted what they had, but I am a third-generation agnostic Jew. Jews themselves aren't necessarily that religious. Some are extremely religious, some aren't. There's a long tradition within Judaism of not of being almost anti-religious and anti-establishment. I come from a long line of people who didn't believe in the orthodoxy or the God of Judaism. I'm still Jewish. I'm very Jewish in my knowledge of the culture, my understanding, and all that. And actually within the traditions of questioning within Judaism, because there's a lot of questioning. I mean, if you recall, Abraham argued with God about Sodom and Gomorrah, and Moses had his own arguments with God. There's a long tradition within the Old Testament about arguments with God. But at any rate, I didn't have a God. I never went to synagogue. I never participated and never believed in a God, nor did my father and mother, nor did my grandparents. And here I had to listen to people read steps about God, God as we understood him, God. And I would go to meetings and hear people talk about a God that was so foreign to what I thought of, that was so different from anything I believed in. It was, you know, my God found me a parking spot. You know, my God, you know, did this for me and did that for me. And it was so different from anything I believed in that I had a great deal of difficulty accepting, except the fact that I was desperate. And I needed something, and I knew these people had something. So I knew I wanted it. And all they said to me was, do the steps and you'll get something. If they had said to me, find God before you do the steps, I couldn't have joined. I couldn't have done it. But the promise of this program, and what step two is all about, it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And came to believe not in God, but that a power greater than me, could restore me to sanity. And it turns out there is that power. And that power isn't necessarily a God in the normal sense of God, but it can be a God in the normal sense of God. It's a very inclusive concept. So the chapter We Agnostics is addressed to people like me. And it's found, I just got to move this microphone slightly. It's found... Something happened. It's found on page 44 of the English book and page 63 of the Danish version. Now, an agnostic depends on how you translate, how you use the words, but I would take an agnostic to be a person who doesn't know whether there's a God or not, but is quite content not to know. And an atheist is a person who knows there is no God. I have studied a great deal of philosophy. It is still one of my passions, and I still read books. I've been greatly influenced by mostly by Aristotle and Kant, with some Kierkegaard in there. I am content to know that I will never know. There are many people in this room, I'm sure, who say, "Oh, you'll know someday," But I'm content to live my life knowing that I will never be able to know. And the chapter We Agnostics is addressed mostly to people like me. But for people who are religious, and I'm sure there are many in this room who believe in a God, who follow a particular God of a particular religion, they may ask, well, why should I read this chapter? And many people don't. There are two important reasons why this chapter should be read by a person who is a devoutly religious person. First, you will meet people like me as you sponsor, and you have a duty to explain to me why I am also worthy of being a member of OA. And that's really significant. You have to learn to discuss the spiritual aspect of this program in a way that doesn't exclude people like me. Secondly, and I think in many ways, well, I won't say most importantly, more importantly, you will find out why, if you are a deeply religious person, why you keep relapsing and why you have problems with food and why you can't get abstinent on your own. Even though you believe in God, you can't stop. And if that's the case, you will find out from this chapter why that is and what the solution is. That's towards the end of the chapter. I'll keep you in suspense. So we begin this chapter with a very interesting couple of sentences. AA has a pamphlet called 44 Questions to See If You Are an Alcoholic. OA has 15 questions to see if you're a compulsive eater. The Big Book has two questions, only two. And Joe and Charlie point this out, and they sort of make fun of AA's pamphlet, because really there are only two questions if you accept the notion that there's something abnormal about our body and something abnormal about our mind. That the body can't stop once it starts, and the mind can't stop from starting. So they say, in the preceding chapters you've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and non-alcoholic. Period. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. That's the mind problem. You can't stop from going back. Your mind keeps sending you back. Or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, that's the body problem. Once you start, you can't stop. You're probably alcoholic. So if you have one or the other of the problems, you probably are an alcoholic. You have to acknowledge that. That's what step one is all about. You have to understand and acknowledge deeply in your heart that you have both the abnormality of the body, what the Big Book calls an allergy, but very broad concept of allergy, meaning any abnormal reaction. The abnormal reaction is cravings, uncontrollable cravings. You have to accept that you have an abnormality of the body, an allergy towards certain kinds of foods or certain kinds of eating behaviors. And you have to accept that you have a mind that will always persuade you to go back. I didn't mention this, but it's a good example when I talk about the mind. You probably know of this, or you've heard of it. I will give you, I have to work out the exchange rate, 25,000 kroner if you don't think of the word rhinoceros for 20 seconds. I will win that bet, because no matter how hard you close your eyes and you put your fingers in your ears and you go la 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 la, at a certain point within 10 seconds your mind is going to say, and I'm not thinking about the word rhinoceros, because you cannot control your mind completely. This is a fact. We have at least three levels to our minds, and sometimes when we're really sick we have 10, and one of those levels is out of your control. You can hold on to two or three of them, but you won't be able to hold on to all of them. And sooner or later, your mind is going to come up with this obsessive idea that you can have some. And it will come out in thousands of different excuses, but ultimately, as I said, it is just, oh, you can. Come on. Just, come on. And that will be more persuasive than all the arguments, all the good arguments, for why you shouldn't. And some of it'll seem reasonable. In some way, you'll just click and you'll do it. So the Big Book goes on and says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And they say on page 45, which is page 64, paragraph 1 of the Danish edition, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously, which is the second shortest sentence of the English version of the Big Book. It had to be a power greater than ourselves. Of course, because we on our own cannot do it. That's what we learned in step one. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. Not that will help you solve your problem, which will solve your problem. And again, the solution means that we are not cured. We will always have to keep solving the problem. We will always have to work the steps to keep what we have. But it will solve your problem. So they start off in this chapter by saying all kinds of problems. People have all kinds of problems with the word God. They have all kinds of problems with religion. And they say on page 46, Danish version, paragraph 2 of page 65, much to our relief, we discovered that we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps, the steps, the 12 steps. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men and women. And page 47, or paragraph 3 of page 65 of the Danish version, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies, too, to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you, stop you, from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to effect our first conscious relation with God as we understood him. Afterward, we find ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. This was growth, but if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere, so we used our own conception. And they say we need to ask ourselves but one short question: do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he's on his way. So willingness is the key. And some people have read step two as sort of a precondition for going on to steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, etc. It's not. From the big book perspective, it is simply a willingness to try. And put very practically, it is. I have this problem that I cannot solve on my own. You seem to have found a solution to the same problem I have. I'd like to try what you've tried. I'd like to try your solution. And it's no more than that, and it's not a dramatic thing. It is no more than that. I'd like to find a faith that gives me what you have. And if you recall what I talked about yesterday, by meeting all these incredible recovered alcoholics who had been on the street and in the gutter, who had a depth of understanding of the world and a compassion and a tolerance and just a serenity that is something I wanted. We had the promises read during the meeting at the break. They had those, and I wanted them. I didn't want to find a God that I had to kneel down and pray to. I didn't want to find a God that required me to go to religion, a religious ceremony. I didn't think I'd ever believe in that. But I wasn't worried about that, because that's not what they were asking me to do. They were asking me to do things that I could accept as being reasonable things to do, to get honest with myself, to get honest with another human being, to make up for whatever wrongs I had done. I didn't know what wrongs I had done, but if I had done any wrongs, I'd like to make up for them, to think of others rather than myself, and to look for guidance from something. Not a terrible thing to do. And so willingness is so important. And the big book goes on page 48. I don't know why. I thought I had done a good translation. Oh, yeah, no, I do have it. Page 66, paragraph 4 of the Danish version. To give you arguments as to give the agnostic and the atheist arguments for believing in a higher power, or for being willing to believe. Now, as I say, I've studied a lot of philosophy. I've read some very difficult philosophers and had them explained to me and begun to understand them. I am purely a student of these philosophers. I don't think I'll ever be a master of them. But they are brilliant people, and Kant and Aristotle, these are people who have minds that are 20 million times bigger than mine. But I've read them, and I've read intricate philosophical arguments, and I used to read this chapter and think that it was second-rate philosophy. It wasn't very good. It was unlike all the other chapters. It wasn't brilliant. The other chapters were brilliant. But once I started really to study this book and saw how brilliant it was in so many other respects, I figured I would go back and analyze it and see if maybe it was a lot smarter than I thought it was. And surprising enough, it is a lot smarter. It's the book, in many ways, should have subtitles, just sort of subsections that should tell you what it's doing at any particular time. I've tried to do that. One of the handouts here is called a schematic outline of the big book. It sort of breaks it down into the different parts of it. And what I want to do is give you the arguments that the big book provides for why an atheist or an agnostic should be willing to work the steps, should be willing to try to find a power greater than yourself. These are arguments that you will, whether you're religious or not, want to use if you find an agnostic or atheist that you're sponsoring, if you find someone you're sponsoring is an agnostic or atheist. And they're very strong philosophical arguments. The first one begins in the middle of page 48, or in the fourth paragraph on page 66 of the Danish version. And I'll give it to you very briefly. I'm not going to read every sentence. Well, I'm not going to read many sentences of it. It works on the scientific principle that if a theory works, it's worth believing in. We've never seen an electron. We've never seen a molecule. We've never seen an atom. Yet we, most of us, I guess, believe that these things exist because their existence explains electricity, the movement of the stars, the movement of the Earth. Scientific theories work. It explains how jet planes work or how all the things that we've taken for granted in our lives work. So the principles of science that we believe in are not principles that we can ourselves verify other than that they work. Does that make sense? Well, that's a good argument. And the big book says, well, here's a theory. You work the steps and you'll recover from a problem of the mind and body. And look, it works. We used to be what you're like, and now we're different from you. We have this freedom. So our theory works. So why shouldn't you believe in it if you're a good scientific thinker? Try it. And, you know, that's a pretty good argument. They point out this on page 50, which is paragraph 4 on page 68 of the Danish version. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power, and to do certain simple things, the steps, there's been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements, the steps. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. And it is powerful. It works for them. If they say, if I look at a person who has recovered, and I see that person saying the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of my life, not abstinence, as I told you before, but the consciousness of the presence of God, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. So that's a simple argument. Try it because it works, and a theory that works is worth believing in. Good. That's one argument. The second argument takes that a little bit further. It says that there is no progress in scientific advancement. There's no progress in science other than people who think outside established concepts. And that's a true fact. There's a wonderful book written on that called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. I think that's what it's called. I'm just reading a very thick book and very, very interesting, but how revolutions in science occur. And they always occur by changing what's called the paradigm, by changing the context in which people have been thinking, by saying, let's look at it in another way. They use the example of Galileo and Columbus. Columbus may not have been the first person in the world who thought the Earth was round, but certainly the example of Columbus willing to sail off into what other people thought would be the edge of the world and not dropping off, the image of Galileo saying, well, gee, maybe the stars revolve around the sun. Maybe the Earth revolves around the sun, and maybe the sun revolves is part of a larger galaxy. Maybe that's a way of explaining the problems we're having. I mean, up until Galileo's time and Copernicus's time, the theory that the sun and the stars revolved around the Earth worked well in navigation until ships began going further than the short distances that they had been going. Once they went further, then the theory wasn't working because the stars weren't working according to the way you could predict them if they were traveling around the Earth. And so the theory wasn't working, and Galileo and Copernicus came up with different theories. So they had a different approach. And they go on, they talk. Well, I hear an example of up until 1952 or 54, no one believed that you could run a 4-minute mile. What is it, 1.6 kilometers in 4 minutes. And no one believed that, and no one could ever do it. Until two Englishmen, Roger Bannister and John Landry, decided that it might be possible. And they trained and trained for it. And in 19, I think it was 54, in the Vancouver Olympics, or the Vancouver Summer Games, Pan American Games, in Vancouver, Canada, they both broke the 4-minute mile. And now you can't run competitively. You can't run the mile race without breaking the 4-minute mile. It's impossible to run it competitively. They broke the mold. They broke the paradigm. Another example is this, and I have a wonderful quote. They talk in the big book right at the bottom, page 51, and I'm afraid I can't see that I... Oh, no, it's page 68 of the Danish version, paragraph 2. 68. They talk about American newspapers were afraid to print an account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Had not all efforts at flight failed before? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River? And I have a quote from the New York Times that was given to me, and I assume it's correct. I haven't checked it. This is December the 10th, 1903. It was an editorial. There was a big symposium the New York Times had of the impossibility. This is a great newspaper, the New York Times. All the major mathematicians and physicists, and they had a symposium of whether or not there would ever be a heavier-than-air flying machine. And this is what they said. Oh, and I guess the U.S. War Department funded Professor Langley, who tried to create a heavier-than-air flying machine that kept crashing. So this is what the New York Times said. We hope Professor Langley will not put his substantial greatness as a scientist in further peril by continuing to waste his time and the money involved in further airship experiments. Life is short, and he is capable of services to humanity incomparably greater than can be expected to result from trying to fly. For students and investigators of the Langley type, there are more useful employments. That was December the 10th, 1903. 1 week later, on December the 17th, 1903, in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, two bicycle mechanics flew a heavier-than-air flying machine. They clearly didn't read the New York Times. And this was, again, breaking the mold. If you don't think it's possible, it's not going to happen. And the big book says, why don't you apply this willingness to try different things and this knowledge that trying different things might result in different results? You know, we talk about the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Why don't you try different things so you get different results? And the big book says... we have to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems. This is on page 52, page 70, paragraph 1 of the Danish version. We have to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. These are called the bedevilments, by the way. There are 8 of them. And these are all sort of symptoms. Not all of them occur to all of us, but they are symptoms of our problems. And they say, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. That's the second argument. Change the perspective. Try something different because what you're doing doesn't work. And that's a very strong argument. So we've got the two arguments. The third argument, though, is the most powerful. They talk about, and this happens it begins on page 52 in the last paragraph, or paragraph 3 on page 70 of the Danish version. They talk about the Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment. So without that, nothing could have happened. We agnostic and atheists were sticking to the idea that self-sufficiency would solve our problems. When others showed us that God's sufficiency worked with them, we began to feel like those who would insist that the Wrights would never fly. They talk about how logic is great and it's a magnificent achievement. And then they say, right in the middle of page 53, which is, I guess, the last paragraph of page 70 of the Danish version, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade. You notice, self-imposed crisis, because there is a solution, self-imposed on us. We had to fearlessly face the proposition, either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? On page 71, paragraph 1 of that of the Danish version, middle of page 53 of the English version, arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith. The outlines and the promise of the new land had brought luster, a halo of light, to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't quite step ashore. Perhaps we'd been leaning too heavily on reason that last mile, and we did not like to lose our support. This image is a wonderful image, this notion of the bridge, and there's almost like a gap we have to step over. It is, I believe, and there may be people here who have studied Kierkegaard more than I have, there probably are, a very great philosopher. He talked about what he called, at least in English, the leap of faith. I don't know what it is in Danish. But it is the concept that at some point you must take a leap into the unknown. Because you cannot have faith without a leap. And you cannot have a leap without faith. It's a combination. If I understand him correctly, and forgive me, Kierkegaard scholars, I know it's the 200th anniversary. I'm sure people are reading him more. But this concept of the leap of faith is so powerful. You know, as a student of Kant's, Kant actually, it's not worth going into great detail, but if I understand Kant correctly, he talked about how we could never know whether there was a God or not, and he was able to sort of prove the existence and the non-existence of God simultaneously. It's a wonderful section of his Critique of Pure Reason. And because you can never know, and that's what he said. And he said the reason he did that, he was a devoutly faithful man, a devoutly religious man. He said, I had to get rid of reason and knowledge in order to make room for faith. And Kierkegaard built on that and built on the concept of taking the leap. Because if you can never know, you might say, well, fine, if I can never know, I don't believe. And Kierkegaard had this concept, yeah, you have to take a leap. But, you know, I don't want to take a leap. I don't have faith in anything. What is the argument that the Big Book is going to say? If I have to take a leap, what is the argument? Well, here's where the Big Book really gets me. Because it is absolutely true. Right at the bottom of page 53, and it's paragraph 2 and page 71 of the Danish version. That was natural, but let us think a little more closely. Without knowing it, had we not been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith? For did we not believe in our own reasoning? Did we not have confidence or ability to think? What was that but a sort of faith? Yes, we had been faithful, abjectly, hopelessly faithful to the God of reason. So in one way or another, we discovered that faith had been involved all the time. That's a cute argument. I look at that and say, you're right, it's true. I cannot use logic without believing in logic. You can't use logic to prove logic, because logic is there to use in proving other things, and therefore I believe in logic and I can't prove it. Okay, that's cute. I like that. That's nice. But then they go on. And the next paragraph killed me. It absolutely, you know, put me right between, stuck the knife right in and twisted it. And then this is paragraph 3 on page 71 of the Danish version, the first paragraph on page 54. We found, too, that we had been worshippers. What is state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on? Goose flesh is this, this. What is it?
Gozeru.
Oh, so it's goose flesh too. Isn't that interesting? Okay. I assume the goza is goose, right? Oh, I love that name, goose skin, goose flesh. Anyway, they use goose twice in the big book. One is here, goose flesh, and the other is the goose hung high. Bill talks about it. I don't know if goose is important. Anyway, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, I talked about the time I ate an entire goose skin. So, what a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. Had we not variously worshipped, variously means in different ways, worshipped people, sentiment, things, money, and ourselves? And then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower? Who of us had not loved something or somebody? How much do these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing, we saw at last. Were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? All kinds of things motivate me that are not rational. When my daughters were born, I was lucky enough to be in the delivery room with them. I held them in my arms. I knew with my first daughter, I held her in my arms after 1 minute of her life. She was 1 minute old or 2 minutes old. And I knew I would die for her. And it would be instinctive. It would not even be a question. I wouldn't even sort of think, what should I, or is it reasonable? I'd die for her. And as I've said, when she, between the ages of 12 and 16, I often regret that. She was a wonderful challenge. She's just the most wonderful person. And she was even then, but not to us. And my younger daughter the same. And that's not rational. At the moment she was 2 seconds old or 2 minutes old or 5 minutes old, even a year old, I was more useful to the world than she was. Given a choice, any rational person would have chosen me and not her to live. But it's not rational. And my love for my wife, my love for other things and other people, these are not rational choices. They're the heart. And yet they are the most important things in my life. And I would do things for love that I would not do rationally. And that's true for all of us. We sometimes very badly, we do things for love that are really silly. We know they're silly but harmful. But we do them because they are more, and they're not rational. And we do them. So our motivations are ultimately based on things that we believe in, but not things that we have, not conclusions we've come to on a rational basis. Well, if that's the case, then who am I to say there is no God? Who am I to say I don't have faith? Clearly, I have faith in some things that I can't prove. And therefore, I am a person who has taken a leap of faith, even without acknowledging it. However cold and rational I think I am a person who worships and has faith. And therefore, I am a hypocrite if I say there is no God, because I believe in something. That's a very powerful argument. It overwhelms any argument that can be made about not believing. You don't have to believe in God as the God is described by any religion, but you do have to admit that you believe in something. Otherwise, you would not be alive. We all believe in something. And the big book goes on, the fourth paragraph on page 71 of the Danish version, and the last paragraph, or the second last paragraph on page 54. Imagine life without faith. Were nothing left but pure reason, it wouldn't be life. But we believed in life. Of course we did. We couldn't prove life in the sense that you can prove a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. Yet there it was. I mean that is so true. And they go on, they say, hence we saw that reason isn't everything. Neither is reason, as most of us use it, entirely dependable, though it emanates from our best minds. So that argument is it should be very powerful to any agnostic. You do believe in something. And my first sponsor asked me a very simple question about God. He said, is there anything that you would willingly die for? Or that is more important than you are? Well, easy for me to answer with love. Love is clearly more important than I am. And I know that I would die for my children, my wife, I would like to think I'd die for more people, but at least I'd die for those three. And I also would like to think I'm courageous enough, but I know it's more important than I am, to die. But certainly I believe that truth and justice and beauty are more important than I am. I don't know whether I'd be courageous enough to die for them, but I believe that they are more important than I am. So I came back after some thought to my sponsor and I said, I believe in truth, love, justice, and beauty as being more important things than I am. He said, call it God. I said, that's not God. God is some guy with a beard who is a puppet master. I said, no, it's your own conception of God. Call it God. Call it good orderly direction, if you will. I don't care what you call it, but that is your higher power. And I had to understand, well, what is it that the steps are going to do for me in relation to that? Well, now comes the page, or the section of the big book, which explains why a belief in anything isn't enough. Whether you believe in a particular kind of God, or you believe in truth, love, justice, and beauty, or you believe in light, or the spirit, or whatever. It doesn't matter what you believe in. Why does a mere belief not work to keep us from compulsively eating? Well, the big book says on page 55 of the English version, paragraph 3, page 72 of the Danish version, actually we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured. Obscured means blocked off. Obscured. By calamity, bad things that have happened. By pomp, a sense of self-importance. By worship of other things, money, prestige, other people's opinions. But in some form or other, it is there. And they go on, they say, we finally saw that, well, for faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly. Step 4, a searching and fearless moral inventory. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. And in last analysis, it is only there he may be found. It was so with us. So to deeply religious people who can't get it, who keep on eating and ask why, I pray all the time, I'm a good religious person, why is God not helping me? The answer is, you have blocked God off from you. It has been obscured by calamity, by pomp, and by worship of other things. And the solution is to unblock the pipeline, to unblock the artery, to unblock the line between what you believe in, say, in your heart, and how you act and think in your head. That's all the steps do. They unblock the line. They allow a direct connection between what you deeply believe in and how you act and think, between your heart and your mind. And whether you are deeply religious in a very specific sense, or whether you're completely non-religious and skeptical, agnostic, or atheist, which is more my camp, whatever you believe in, the steps will unblock the blockage, so that what you believe in wells up and becomes part of you. And when you go back to what Carl Jung said, this spiritual thirst for wholeness, this hunger, this spiritual hunger for wholeness, it is that same concept. I know that there's a gap, there's a hole in my heart as big as the universe. And it needs to be filled, and it's going to be filled only if I unblock the connection. I'm not living according to what I believe in. If I lived according to what I believed in, my God would give me all the power I needed. Clearly, I'm not. Does that make sense? You know, and this image of the unblockage is so powerful, and we'll see it come up when the big book discusses step 4. And we'll see that when we discuss it in step 11 in the prayer and meditation, we'll see that this direct connection is what it's all about. That ultimately we're looking, Bill called it the fourth dimension of existence, and I think it is simply that direct connection between our higher power, whatever we believe in, our deepest values, whatever they are, whether they're the particular kind of God of a particular religion, or whether they're truth, love, justice, and beauty, or any other deep value, it is the direct connection between those values and how we think and act on a day-to-day basis. And if we can live and act and think according to what we believe in, we are whole people. And as long as we're whole people, we're sane. Because there's no insanity in there living differently from what we believe in. And as long as we're sane, we will know that to eat ice cream for me, whatever your food is for you, is poison. And we won't forget that it's poison. And we will always know that. That's a byproduct, in a sense, of the wholeness that we're getting. That's what the steps do. And I must tell you, it's so simple when it was explained to me, and as I'm now explaining to you, it's such a simple concept. This matter of unblocking the blockage. That's all the steps do. It's no magic to it. I mean, it is miraculous. It ends up being a miraculous effect, but it's not a magical thing. As we go through steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, it will be obvious to you from the Big Book perspective why you have that blockage, or why I had that blockage, and why I continue to get that blockage if I don't deal with it on a regular basis. Our minds are such that we do put that blockage up. And we'll find out in step 3 in the discussion before step 3 why our minds are like that. And we'll find out why the steps work for us to unblock it. Many people don't have that problem. Many people live lives directly. They don't have to think through anything and they don't have to work through it. It's a direct connection between them and their higher power, whatever they believe in. They act according to what they believe in. And those people who do that are sane people, sane human beings. They're whole. And that's what we're searching for. So that's really the discussion of step 2. And you may not know this, but nowhere in the Big Book is there a mention that that's what step 2 is. You know, step 2 is defined when we get to page 59 of the Big Book, when we start to read the steps out loud. But nowhere in this book do they say, you've now done step 2 or you've taken step 2. Step 2 is simply willingness. That's all it is. And willingness comes from an open mind. A mind that says, I'd like to try something that might work for me. And, you know, here's where I'm going to start telling jokes, where I am curious to know how well they'll work with people whose language is second language is English. I'm really curious. I'm going to try them. There's one I'm going to tell when we get to the end of step 9 that is really, really, it's very Jewish. It requires a, I don't know whether it'll work, but I'll explain it if it does. If I don't get laughter, I'll explain it. But here's another Jewish joke, and it rests on a certain stereotype, but it doesn't matter. There's a play going on, and suddenly in the middle of the play, one actor falls down onto the floor, collapses. And the audience thinks maybe it's part of the play, and the actors, all the other actors, are trying to sort of pretend that it's part of the play. But at a certain point, it becomes impossible, and they close the curtain. And then the stage manager comes out and says, "Is there a doctor in the house?" And the doctor comes out, and there's a hubbub, and the lights are up, and no one knows what's going on. And then the doctor and the stage manager come out, and the stage manager says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm so sorry to tell you, this actor has just died. It's a tragedy. We have to cancel the show. And you'll get your money, just go to the box office, we'll give him some chicken soup," comes from the audience. And the doctor says, "What'd you say? Give him some chicken soup." And the doctor says, "The man is dead." And from the audience says, "It can't hurt." Okay, well, it's not bad. It can't hurt. What do you lose if you try these steps? You know, really, that's the last argument I'm just giving to you. What do you lose? You might lose some pounds, and you might lose a few weeks. Try it. It can't hurt. And really, that's all step 2 is, a willingness to try. It is, I'm desperate because I know that I will never solve this problem on my own. I have some hope because there are people here who have told me what they used to be like and what they're like now, and I want what they have. Why don't I try it? And really, that's the gift that I was given by the alcoholic who told me I should start taking my food as seriously as he took his alcohol, the gift that I had the right to take myself seriously, was probably the most important thing. And I think in a way we have to learn how to explain the seriousness of this problem and the depths of despair that we have had. At any rate, we're now on to the we're almost there in terms of action. Almost. We haven't done anything yet. We've sat around and talked. Well, I hope we've done one thing, and that is we've developed a plan of eating. But we haven't yet really started to do anything. If you recall, the steps begin with, we got honest with ourselves. Well, we're not even going to do that. We've got step three to deal with. Now, what I want to do with step three is to talk a bit about the history, because I'm going to be trying to persuade you of something that may be contrary to the way you've been brought up in OA or in any other 12-step program. Every 12-step program has a book called The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. I'm not sure every one of them, but certainly the big ones have them. Al-Anon has one, Narcotics Anonymous has one, Gamblers Anonymous has one, OA has one, and I'm sure many other 12-step fellowships have a book called 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. They're all modeled after the original one, the AA 12 and 12, which it's called the 12 and 12, the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, which consist of essays on the steps written by Bill Wilson. Brilliant, brilliant essays. By the way, someone was quoting, we've never been at the top, we're always at the top of the heap or down below, hiding. You know, that wonderful quote during the OA meeting, that's from the 12 and 12, step 4. I actually was going to quote it, but now I won't. But it's a great quote. We've never been one among many, a member of the family, a worker among workers. We've always strived to be at the top of the heap or to dive down deep below. We've never been equal. Never been an equal person. We've always been the best or the worst. And as Bill says in another essay, there is no difference between saying I'm the best and between saying I'm the worst. They're both pride. Pride and guilt are the same thing. It's a wonderful essay he's written. Anyway, those books have had an influence on the fellowship because they are interpretations of each step. And they have, generally speaking, the same number of pages devoted to every step. So people think, would be reasonable, that every step deserves to be have the same amount of time devoted to it as every other step. And what I want to do is go through the history to talk about what is a fact, is that there were originally only six steps, and that the 12 steps were developed simply, well, I'll let Bill describe it when I read to you from what Bill has written about. If I can, yeah, I have it. I told you yesterday that a draft of the big book was distributed. I think I did, or maybe I did this morning. A draft of the big book was distributed in, I think, 1938 to 400 people for their comments. And they came back with a lot of comments, both in AA, and there were psychiatrists, and there were doctors and religious people who were all given copies of the book and asked to comment on it. One major contributor of comments was Dr. Harry Thibault, who was Bill's psychiatrist, or became Bill's psychiatrist. And he said the main thing that you should do was to change the way in which the book was written. The book was originally written, you should do this, you should do that, do this, do this, you should do that. He said no alcoholic, or most alcoholics, will resist being told what to do, but they will not resist copying what you've done. Why don't you change it to say, this is what we did, rather than you should do it. So a number of the changes between the draft and the first edition consisted of changing it from you should to we did. Wonderful, really significant changes. And there were other changes as well. And I'm going to read, when we read How It Works, Chapter 5, I'm going to read some of the changes which were beyond that. I just wanted to distribute you, you might be interested, the final version of the draft, which was used to send to the printer, which all the changes that were agreed upon were put in, has now been published in a book that you can buy. It's a very large book. I think it's called The Book That Shaped the World. And you can buy it from various, you know, different places that booksellers are. And I'm going to distribute, they were put online, a copy of the foreword and a copy of How It Works, to show you how the changes were made. It's really interesting to look at. But the book is fascinating. It really is fascinating. So I wonder if someone could come and pick it up, and if you could pick it up and then just go through it. So if you would turn to page 58 in the English version, and that's page 75 in the Danish version, How It Works. I don't know. Do any of you read this at the beginning of your meetings? Yeah. And I'll read it with the changes, with the original wording, some of the original wording. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. You say directions. And I wish that had been kept so it was clear that this was a book of directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And Bill was asked, why did you put that in? Why did you make it so discouraging? Why did you give people a way in saying, oh, maybe I'm one of those people who can't be rigorously honest? He said, I have to tell the truth. And, I mean, the truth is, and we know people, we've met people in the program. It is a sad fact that I've been in the program for 26 years in my hometown, and my absence of 20 years is about the longest. There's only one other person that has longer than I have. And some of the people, many of the people who were there when I started, who themselves had 10 or 15 years of abstinence, are gone. And I've seen some of them, and some of them are dead because they're gone. They left the rooms. We see people. And I've had friends in the program who have been incapable of being rigorously honest. It also helps us to be able to say to people, your problem is that you're not being honest enough. If you're having trouble working this program, maybe you should consider whether you're being honest enough. But anyway, that's what he said. Then they go on. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, and this is a major point, you have to decide that you're willing to go to any length to get what we have. They remind us of this promise later on, or of this decision later on. Remember, you agreed you'd go to any lengths. Then you are ready to, it used to say, follow directions. It now says, take certain steps to follow directions. At some of these, we balked. We stopped. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. And it used to say, we doubt if you could. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil, nothing, until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. And I know that we will always translate, remember that we deal with food, cunning, baffling, powerful. I would prefer to say, remember that we deal with our killer foods, or our binge foods, or our eating behaviors, our killer eating behaviors, because not all food is cunning, baffling, and powerful to me. I have never in my life been baffled by radishes. Never. That's about it, I think. No. Brains. My mother used to eat brains. I couldn't eat them. So I couldn't eat brains. I've never been baffled by brains either. Anyway, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. Availed helped us in no way. Half measures, three-quarter measures, 11/12 measures. It's the all the steps or none of the steps. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. It used to say, throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. I'm glad they changed that to we asked his protection and care. And then it used to say, now we think you can take it. I'm glad they took that out. Here are the steps which we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. And the wording, I don't know what it's like in other translations, but the wording here is clear. It's the whole program that is suggested, not each step. It's not take what you like and leave the rest when it comes to this program. It's all or nothing here. It's an entire program. And for those of you who have not yet taken the steps and are looking at, you know, step 8 and step 9 and saying, I'm never going to apologize to that son of a bitch, you know, or anything like that, believe me, you may not have to. You know, the steps are in an order for a good reason. They gradually become more and more clear. Your path becomes clear as you work them. Don't anticipate. Don't anticipate. You will find that as you work one step, the next step becomes clearer and more desirable. So don't give up by looking ahead of it and saying, Don't censor yourself in step four by saying, I won't put this person down because I don't want to apologize. You know, because there's a whole process you go through. Anyway, some of the steps were changed from the initial draft. But I'll read them over. Well, before I read them over, I want to read to you Bill's description of how he wrote the steps. He talks in a few different places, but I'm taking this from the language of the heart. He says, during the next 3 years after Dr. Bob's recovery, which is 1935, our growing groups at Akron, New York, and Cleveland evolved the so-called word-of-mouth program of our pioneering time. As we commenced to form a society separate from the Oxford group, we began to state our principles something like this. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Excuse me, step one. Two, we got honest with ourselves. Step four. Three, we got honest with another person in confidence. Step five. Four, we made amends for harms done others. Step nine. Five, we worked with other alcoholics without demand for prestige or money. Step 12. Six, we prayed to God to help us do these things as best as we could. Step 11. So there were only steps 1, 4, 5, 9, 11, and 12. All the other steps did not exist until one day after Bill wrote the first few chapters of the Big Book. He says, I well remember the evening on which the 12 steps were written. I was lying in bed quite dejected and suffering from one of my imaginary ulcer attacks. Four chapters of the book Alcoholics Anonymous had been roughed out and read in meetings at Akron in New York. We quickly found that everyone wanted to be an author. The hassles as to which should go into our new book were terrific, meaning bad, horrible. For example, some wanted a purely psychological... I'm going to skip this. The louder these arguments, the more I felt in the middle. It appeared that I wasn't going to be the author at all. I was only going to be an umpire who would decide the contents of the book. Having arrived at Chapter 5, it seemed high time to state what our program really was. I remember running over in my mind the word-of-mouth phrases then in current use. Jotting these down, they added up to the six named above, the ones I just read to you. Knowing the alcoholic's ability to rationalize, something airtight would have to be written. We couldn't let the reader wiggle out anywhere. Besides, a more complete statement would help in the chapters to come, where we would need to show exactly how the recovery program ought to be worked. And so Bill wanted to make sure that between each of the steps that were there were, that no one could wriggle out, no one could get out from under the transition between one step and another. And that's why the other steps were put in. He said, at length I began to write on a cheap yellow tablet. I split the word-of-mouth program up into smaller pieces, meanwhile enlarging its scope considerably. Uninspired as I felt, I was surprised that in a short time, perhaps half an hour, I had set down certain principles, which on being counted turned out to be 12 in number. And for some unaccountable reason, I had moved the idea of God into the second step, right up front. When this document was shown, there were all kinds of protests, and let's keep it simple, let's go back to 5 or 6. But finally they accepted that there should be 12 steps. And from the history of AA, and from the way, and the Big Book mirrors the history, you'll find that the steps that Bill put in the middle are short. They're not long. There's a paragraph here and there written about them. There's not the same depth that Bill gives, or that the Big Book gives, to the steps that originally existed. And that's why I say that the Big Book shows that you can do step 5, 6, 7, and 8 the same day. Because there wasn't ever a 6, 7, and 8 until Bill created 6, 7, and 8. They were moments in time, and as we get to them, I'll talk about what that means, but they were moments in time. We'll find out that step two isn't a step you take, it's just a willingness. It's just a desperation, willingness. Powerlessness, power. You know, step one is powerlessness, step two is power. Step one is desperation, step two is hope. You know, or despair, hope. Step one is problem, step two is solution. They're not steps, they're the essence of your sense of, I have this problem, I have hope. and that's it. I can't solve it on my own, and I have hope. And people talk about taking step one and taking step two. I didn't take step one, but I became desperate, and I became hopeful, but that served me no good whatsoever until I made a decision and then did the steps. Step three never existed until Bill created it. We'll find out as we read step three, it's a prayer. That's all it is. It's taking a prayer. It's a moment in time where you take a prayer. It is simply a decision. But before we get there, I'm going to read the steps as they first existed. Okay, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That our lives have become unmanageable. I know the Danish translation says, and that our lives have become unmanageable. I know that our OA 12 and 12 suggests that these are equivalent, that we have to accept two of these, both of these things. That's not what this step says. And the discussion of step one in the big book is all about the unmanageability of alcohol. So powerless over alcohol, I think, refers to the allergy of the body, the inability of the body to stop once it starts. And unmanageability means we can't manage our lives without alcohol. We keep going back to it, which I think is the mental obsession. But in the English, it says, we admit we're powerless over alcohol, dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. That our lives have become unmanageable is a subordinate clause that modifies the major clause. That's too technical, and I have no idea whether the same words mean anything in your languages. So, but at any rate, it's not equal. The and would make them equal. And then two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Came to believe, not did believe, not decided to believe, not we didn't wait until we did believe. We came to believe. This was the promise of the program, is that we have a problem that we can't solve on our own, and step two is ultimately we came to that belief. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care, as you say, care and direction of God. They got rid of the words and direction of God as we understood them. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, it used to say we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. They changed that wording a bit. Seven, I'm glad they changed. It used to say humbly on our knees, ask them to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. And this was Dr. Thibault who said no alcoholic will accept the absoluteness of that, getting on your knees and holding nothing back. Just say, humbly ask them to remove our shortcomings. That's good enough. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all, it used to say. And I'm sure that was the influence of Harry Thibault, who said, don't say complete, because people will say, I'm never going to do it. And that's this whole idea of progress, not perfection. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continue to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God. So now it says our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12 was changed quite a bit. Having had a spiritual experience, it used to say, I told you it used to say that in the first edition, as the result, and by the way, we big book crazy people, thumpers, they're called big book thumpers. We believe in the big book, and we know every line, and we memorize the sentences and all that. We know where the typographical errors are. We always say, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, not as the result of the steps, but as the result of the steps, because the promise of step 12 is that you have a spiritual awakening by doing the steps. So having had a spiritual experience as the result of, just say, this course of action was changed to these steps. We tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics. So they changed that. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. On page 77, the Danish version, paragraph 1, page 60 of the English. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after used to say, have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. And they changed that. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. Those are called the ABCs of the program. You'll note that they incorporate steps one and step two, but in three different ways. They're just not working steps. They're just ideas. That's all they are. And then it used to say, if you are not convinced, either reread this book or throw it away. So they're pretty strong. And I, you know, there's a strength to that. And we'll see when we get to step 12 tomorrow. And I tend to spend a lot of time in step 12 to talk about what good meetings are and how to get more people and how to carry the message. Because I think in OA we do that extremely badly. I mean, the statistics are clear that we don't do it well. We have people who suffer from our illness who don't come to us and have never heard of us. And when they come, they don't stay. So clearly we're not carrying a good message. And we're the custodians of the 12 steps. We're the trustees. We're entrusted with carrying them. And we're not doing a great job of carrying them. So I want to talk about that. But anyway, we will see that the AA way of dealing with it is much tougher. It's just, you know, take it or leave it. I'm not spending any time with you if you're not really interested. And yet we hold on to our people and I'll talk more. And I know I'm going to be very provocative because I'm going to be talking about sponsoring in a way that's very different from the way a lot of people sponsor and or are sponsored. And I believe it's from the Big Book, and I believe that the Big Book says, let no one be dependent upon you, let them be dependent upon God. And therefore, the sponsor should not be in charge of anyone else's life. I don't spend a lot of time with my sponsees. I help them work the steps, and let them work the steps. If they don't work the step, that's their problem. I'm not going to hold their hands. And once they recover, I say, good, go out and help someone else. You don't have to spend any time with me, I've recovered. You know, your job is to help other people, not me. I don't need help. But anyway, I'll talk about that in more detail tomorrow. But I like this idea. If you're not convinced, reread this book or throw it away. You know, there's a wonderful expression which is not all that... it's pretty rude in English. But move your bowels or get off the toilet is another way of putting it. So being convinced... Now, here's where the Big Book... the Big Book really should have, as I said, subheadings and stuff. Because being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. What do we mean by that, and what do we do? And the book first describes what we mean by that, and then the book tells us what we do. It also starts off with talking about will, and then goes on to talk about life. So it's very well organized. But it doesn't look organized because it just looks like a series of interesting paragraphs that somehow seem to be connected, but they don't tell you exactly how. So first of all, they're going to explain what we mean by turning our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand God. And then they're going to tell us how we make that decision. And once we make that decision, then they're going to tell us how to follow through on that decision to actually do something. I'm just trying to decide when I tell my jokes. Well, let me start off by, I want to talk about decision making. Because step three is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. It's just a decision. I can decide to come to Denmark. But unless I buy a ticket and get on the plane, I'm not in Denmark. And so there's no effect of making decision unless it is, as the Big Book says, at once followed by action. And yet we often think that the decision we make should have some great effect on us. The Big Book promises nothing. Well, it promises a little bit when we make a decision, but hardly anything. Because it's just a decision. Remember, it didn't exist until Bill created it to get rid of the loopholes. It's a moment in time when we actually say, yes, I'm ready. I'm ready to do this. And that's it. Nothing more. It's not a momentous time of our lives other than it is the beginning of a journey that will give us a miracle.
That's pretty momentous.
It is the first step in the step of 10,000 miles. Where they say every journey of 10,000 miles begins with a single step. It is simply a moment in time where we say, okay, I'm going to take the first step. I'm about to move my foot. But if you don't move your foot, nothing's going to happen. I'm ready to move my foot. I've decided to move my foot. But you still have to move your foot, which will be steps 4 through 9. So here are some jokes to illustrate that. No, you know what? I'm going to go through this and then I'll tell the jokes, because the jokes fit in better later on. Okay. I'm keeping you in suspense. They're not going to be that funny. So remember, to turn our will and our life over, so first they're going to talk about will, and then they're going to talk about life. So the first discussion of will is found on page 60, the last paragraph, or page 77, paragraph 3 of the Danish version. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I will be breaking, but I'm planning to have one break in this afternoon. So if you feel like going for coffee or anything like that, please feel free. I won't be hurt or bothered by it. I hope that's okay with you. Is it okay to have just one break? It'll be a longish break. We'll have it at 15 to 5. No, that's it. Probably around 3:15. Okay, so about 20 minutes. So a life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with someone, something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. I remember when that passage was first pointed out to me. And it hit me right between the eyes. That's exactly who I was. I knew how life would be. And I'll tell you, if everyone lived according to the way I wanted life to be lived, it would be a better world. People would be happier. Because I believe in nice things for people. And I want people to live a good life. But people don't, and bad things go on, and things aren't going the way I think they should, and it bothers me. And before I joined this program, it bothered me to the point that my mind was so blocked from what I believed in that I couldn't think right. And so I ate, because my mind kept saying, this will make you feel better. Anyway, he goes on, life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. And I'll tell you, aside from my wife and my children, I think before I joined this program, most people who knew me would have said that I was all those things except modest. I wasn't modest. You know the joke, I used to be conceited, but I got over it. Now I'm perfect. I really was a kind and considerate man, but it was really because I wanted things to be different. And they say, on the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. I was also all those. The outward projection of myself was kind and considerate, but inside I knew there was another part of me. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. So the big book is describing the actor who wants to be in charge of the entire production and is always in collision with other actors who also want to be in charge of the entire production. And it's what I wanted to... Actually, I wanted to be the director of plays. I'd love to be the conductor of a symphony. I'd like to be in charge of all kinds of things. I have no abilities, but I'd love to do that. So they can say, what usually happens? So you can see the motives may be virtuous, they may be bad, or they're probably a mixture. And the big book is starting to describe the kind of people we are in a way that's non-judgmental, in the sense that the motives may be quite good. My wanting there to be a good world, quite virtuous motives. I'm Jewish. I was born in 1945 after the Holocaust occurred. I didn't want the Holocaust to have occurred. That's a pretty virtuous thing. I didn't suffer from it. No one I know suffered from it. Well, I've met some people, some survivors, but no one in my family suffered from it. But I don't want that to occur. I don't want people to die of genocide anywhere in this world. I don't want people to be tortured. I don't want unhappiness to exist. I want there to be poor people. You know, I want there to be a better world. And so those feelings are generally virtuous because I am living well. I mean, if I wanted just for myself, I could just live my own life. And they go on. On the other hand, when I was going out with an ex-girlfriend, I wanted her. I wanted to possess a particular kind of person. And there was a very egotistical and selfish. I wanted to be validated by her. My motives were not particularly good at that point in relation to her. And I would say, frankly, that if I look at my relationship with my wife, I would say that the love I feel for her now is nothing like the love I used to feel for her 42 years ago. It was much more mixed. I was sicker. I was sick then, and I don't think I really understood what love is like as I do now, as I've experienced it now. But the big book is showing that it doesn't matter whether it's for virtuous or bad motives or a mixture. Your problem is you want to be in charge of life. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. I'm on paragraph 4 and on page 77, the Danish version, and the first full paragraph on page 61. The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he's sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can rest means to grab, satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And don't his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people call it. And he gives examples that might be good examples of good people or bad people. It doesn't matter. It goes on page 62 at the top, page 78, Danish version, paragraph 1, right at the end of that paragraph. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. You'll see here, I think you can see, that the definition of selfishness here is not what it is in the dictionary. Now, I don't know how selfish is translated in each of your languages. It may be translated more broadly. But in English, selfish in any dictionary will be defined as wanting things my way to make me feel better, or words to that effect. Wanting things for myself. That's selfish. I want to keep that food for myself so you can't eat it. That's selfish according to the dictionary definition. But the big book's previous discussion of the actor wanting to be the director makes it clear that you can be selfish and have completely virtuous motives, not even thinking of yourself. Your selfishness consists of wanting your way regardless of the motivation. So selfish is being defined in the big book much more broadly than it is in the dictionary. It's being defined as wanting your way in a sense rather than God's way. In a way, wanting your way in a sense different from the way it is. And that's selfish even if you're right. You know, the fact that I don't want there to have been a Holocaust, or I don't want there to be any kind of Holocaust, is not selfish from the dictionary point of view. But from the big book point of view, it is selfish, because the big book has defined selfishness as being much broader. This is extremely important, because when we get to step 4, we'll be asking us where in our resentments we've been selfish. And if we can't answer that question from the big book definition of selfish, we will have left out a whole aspect of our lives which really has caused problems to other people. You know, I remember trying to sponsor a person who was a very controlling mother, at least she said she was. And I said, the selfish means more broadly. She was, her first language was not English. She says, I'm not selfish. My children have to know what to do. They have to know the right thing. It'll do them good if they do the right thing. I said, yes, I know, and your motivations are fine, but the word selfish means, no, I'm not selfish. Couldn't accept the word selfish, because that would mean that somehow she was doing it for her own reasons rather than for her children, and she had sacrificed her entire life for her children. So that's just an example. And then the book says, and here's a sentence which is very important, because it can easily be misinterpreted. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably, we usually always find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. In OA, there are many people who have been hurt as children, who have been subjected to physical and sexual assaults. And you can read that sentence and say, do you mean I deserve it? Do you mean I made a decision based on self which allowed them to hurt me? You mean that I dressed too provocatively when I was 8 years old and allowed some, you know, some pervert to rape me and I deserved that somehow? That's not, I'm clearly, the, you know, if you asked that of Bill Wilson, he would say absolutely not, you know. But you can read it that way, can't you? You know, so that's why I want to discuss it. Charlie gives the best example. He says, when he was 8 years old, his father beat him black and blue. He says, no child deserves to be beaten black and blue. But if 50 years later, his father, who's dead now, is still beating him up in his mind, then clearly at some point in the past, he made a decision to continue to be beaten. And so he made a decision in the past based on self, which continues to place him in a position to be hurt. And I think that's what they mean, that ultimately it's not that you necessarily have done something which created the situation and the hurt, but it's that you continue to be hurt by it. There's an incredibly inspirational story of a woman who in California was abducted by a madman who subjected her to 4 days of horrible assaults and then cut off her arms to leave her to die. And she escaped and was found and she was asked 10 years, and he was found and he was put in jail, and she was asked 10 years later, don't you hate that man? And she said, I gave him 4 days. He took 4 days out of my life. I'm not going to let him take any more. You know? So she clearly has made a decision not to place herself in a position to be hurt. And that's the concept. And I think it's a very powerful concept. But boy, can this be misinterpreted as meaning somehow you deserve what you got, which is clearly not what they mean. Although sometimes it's true. You know, I remember saying about an ex-girlfriend, you know, I'll show her that love can triumph. She can give me anything she got, anything she has, and I'll overcome it. Well, she gave me everything she had, and I was really hurt by it. And then when I did my step 4 on her and step 5, I realized I made that decision that she could try. And I let her try. And I can't blame her. I can only blame myself for continuing to be in that situation because I let myself be hurt. Anyway, they go on. They say, so our troubles, this is page 62 right in the middle, page 78 of the Danish version, paragraph 3. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. And again, selfishness meaning the wish to be in charge, regardless of the motivations. Very important to remember that. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we couldn't live up to them even though we would have liked to. Anyway, I have to skip a bit. Page 79, Danish edition, paragraph 1, page 62. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we have to quit playing God. It didn't work. We have to give up our will. We have to become unselfish. We have to stop trying to be in charge, wanting to be in charge. So that's the will part. The next section now is going to be the life part, our will and our lives. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, now we're talking about life, God was going to be our director. He's the principal, we're his agents, he's the father, we're his children. And they took out of the draft, get that simple relationship straight. And I'm glad they took that out because I have enough trouble with father and children and principal and agent as an agnostic. But at any rate, I can make my translations. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was a keystone of the new and triumphant arcs through which we passed to freedom. So here the concept is, not only do we have to give up trying to be in charge, but we have to have faith that our higher powers, the guidance of our higher power, will do the best it can. you know, those of you who have a religious faith will actually believe that God is doing the best that he can, and that you faith in God will do it. I have to believe that living my life according to truth, love, justice, and beauty will be the best I can do in life. I have to give up being in charge of life, and I have to devote myself to living a life according to truth, love, justice, and beauty. Some people get their direction from God by, in a sense, by having God prod them and push them from behind. Their holy scriptures, their holy, their interpreters of the scriptures, their ministers, their preachers. The things that happen to them in life are all guides to what God wants them to do. So in a sense, God is pushing them in the right direction. And I translate a bit. I think of truth, love, justice, and beauty as being the North Pole or the magnetic north. I think of a compass with 360 different directions, and 359 of them are Laurie's way, and only one of them is the direction of truth, love, justice, and beauty. So I am pulled in the right direction rather than pushed, but I see no difference. It is simply I get a direction from my higher power. What is the direction of truth, love, justice, and beauty? They don't speak to me in the same way that a God might speak to someone who believes in God, but they are the direction I want to go in, the direction of truth, love, justice, and beauty. So the idea is that we turn our will over and then our life over. We give up being in charge of life and we devote our life to our higher power. And that's the nature of the decision we're making. When we make our decision is that we want to find a way to turn our will and our life over. And the promise is that if we work the steps, our will and our lives will be turned over to the care of our God, our higher power. And on page 63, the top of page 63, page 79 of the Danish edition, paragraph 2, are a number of promises. And these promises, some people think are the promises of step 3. Sadly, they're not. If all we had to do was make a decision, we'd have these promises. What's the need for the rest of the steps? These are the promises of the entire program. It says, when we sincerely took such a position, which means that we're actually in the position of giving up our will in our lives, which is not a decision, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Guess who the employer is, with a capital E. It's, you know. And by the way, we don't get our job description until we recover. We get our job description in the chapter Working with Others. Once we've recovered, we're told what our job is. Our job is to be of maximum usefulness to others. That's our job. And we can't do our job until we have recovered and are able to be of help to others. Believe me, before I recovered, I was not of great help to others. I was full of wanting to be in charge of their lives, and that wasn't helping them. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less. And you notice these are we became, we began. So these are all things that happen as we work the steps. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Those are wonderful promises, and they come true later on. Some people interpret in our OE 12 and 12, the Step 3 essay, as saying that the promises of freedom from food come at Step 3, that we're given up and we just do a Step 3 and suddenly we've given up. That can't be what it means. I don't think it is what it means, because clearly making a decision is nothing. I'm going to tell some jokes. We'll do Step 3 and then we'll break. A man falls off a cliff, and just as you see in all the cartoons that you may be familiar with, he's hanging on to the little twig that sticks out from the cliff. You know what I'm talking about, right? Maybe? Yes? Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner? And he yells out, he says, "God, I've never prayed to you before, but if there is a God, help me now." And a deep voice appears to him and says, "I'm here, my son." "God, is that you?" "Yes, my son." "Oh, God, thank you, thank you. What do I do? What do I do?" "Let go of the twig." "Pardon me?" "Let go of the twig, my son." "Is there anyone else up there?" That translates pretty well. So that's the self-will run riot, right? Three frogs sit on a log and two make a decision to jump off the log. How many are left after 5 minutes? It's a trick question. Obviously, someone will say, oh, you tricked me, all three of them are gone because when two of them jump off, the third one. And the answer is none of them do because they only made a decision. And then my favorite joke is a well-known story. It's a man, it doesn't have to be man, it could be a woman, it doesn't matter, but is on the board of a charity, a wonderful charity, and the executive director of that charity steals the money. So they have no money. And they know that in 6 months' time or a year's time, they'll get the money. They'll raise enough money so they can go back in operation. But meantime, it will suffer. It will have to close up because there's no money left. And he has no money. And no one else on the board has money. It's a very worthwhile charity. So he goes to his house. He's a deeply religious man. And he gets on his knees in his small bedroom. And he says, God, I've never asked for anything for myself. And I'm not asking for anything for myself now. My charity needs $100,000. So that's 500,000 kroner. I need to win. The only way I can see doing it, I need to win the lottery. I don't need the six numbers. I just need two numbers to get $100,000. I don't need the 2 million or the 3 million. It will only go to this charity. And I'm going to be on my knees, and I'm going to eat only bread and drink water, and I'm going to pray to you 18 hours a day for the next week. The lottery's on Saturday. It's Sunday today. I'm going to pray. And he does this. And every day, 18 hours, he's praying and praying. And finally, it's Saturday, and he's praying. He says, there's only three more hours to the lottery. I need to remember, I'm only asking for a little bit, just two numbers. That's all I need, two numbers. Please help me. And it's a beautiful sunny day out. But suddenly, black clouds come in from nowhere. And the whole sky is filled with blackness. And there's lightning, but no thunder. It's eerie. The streetlights go on because it's so dark. It's just scary. And suddenly, a shaft of light falls on his face. He doesn't even know where it's coming from. And a frustrated voice says, buy a ticket! Get it? Okay. A decision means nothing if not followed by action. And I'll just prove that just before we say the step three prayer by just asking you to look at the bottom of page 63 in the English edition and the first paragraph of page 80 in the Danish. Next, we launched out in a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, and the decision will be step three prayer, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us from what? From God, from our higher power. So the big book says it means nothing unless we immediately embark on action. So I'll talk about that later. I just want to do the step three prayer and talk about it a bit. The step three prayer, right after it, is we found it very desirable to take the spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. And they say, this was only beginning. So if honestly and humbly made any effect, sometimes a very great one was felt at once. That's the only real promise of step three, any effect. You'll feel an effect. It may be a great one, it may not be. It doesn't matter. You'll feel an effect. Because it will have been a moment when you made a decision. And that's it. So, we'll say the step... by the way, the original draft said, get down on your knees and say to your maker. I'm really glad they changed that. We are now at step three. Many of us said to our makers, we understood them. I don't know if you can say it in English. Say it whatever language you want. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. It's a fascinating prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Why? So I'm no longer self-absorbed? No. So I can better do your will. Take away my difficulties. Why? So I don't have any difficulties? No. So victory over your difficulties will show the power of God to others. And that's the decision we're making, because we're giving up our will in our lives. That's the decision we're making, is to find a way to do that. And that's what we're going to do with steps 4 through 9. Just a brief preview, and then we'll break. Steps 4 through 9, we'll find, are the entire inventory process, not just step 4. We'll find that steps 4 through 9 are the inventory. And in steps 4 through 9, we will face and be rid of the things that block us from the sunlight of the Spirit, from our higher power. I'm going to go into that in some depth. And then we'll find, and you'll find though, that step 4 is probably the longest step. It doesn't have to be all that long, but certainly it's longer than the others. Steps 5, 6, 7, and 8 are done the same day. If you're really tired, you can do some of them the next day. Step 9 is done over a period of whatever time it's practical to do it in. And the promise is, by that time, you've recovered. You've recovered in two ways. One is you have a spiritual awakening, and the promises that were read at the OA meeting come true. We will know the word serenity, we'll know the meaning of peace, and all that. But the other promises, which is the reason I joined this program, not so I'd know the word serenity or not so the past would be nice, but I joined this program to get the next promises, which are freedom from the bondage of food, being able to be around it and not want it, recoiling us from a hot flame. And that's what we get. And then the big book will say, this is how we will be if we keep in fit spiritual condition. They'll talk about keeping in fit spiritual condition as steps 10, 11, and 12. And that's what I do, steps 10, 11, and 12. We will find that step 10 is actually steps 4 through 9 again, that they're the same as steps 4 through 9, but they're not the same because we've recovered already. So we don't do a step 4 through 9, we do a 10. And we'll find 11 and 12 will keep us in recovery. And so someone asked me, do you do steps 1 through 9 again? No, I've never, I don't have to, I've recovered. And I do steps 10, 11, 12. And I'll talk about the difference. Some of you will want to argue about the difference between step 10 and step 11. I'll be happy to have that discussion with you. And we'll break. And however long it takes, and we'll come back shortly, okay? Thanks.